This is Neil Boggs inviting you to Meet the Press. Our guest today on Meet the Press is Walter P. Reuther, president of the United Automobile Workers, whose strike against the Ford Motor Company is in its third week. We'll have the first questions now from Lawrence E. Spivak, permanent member of the Meet the Press panel.
Mr. Reuther, you were reported as saying on Friday that your negotiations with Ford continue in a stalemate. Is the union prepared to make any concessions to break the stalemate, or can the stalemate only be broken by concessions from the automobile workers?
Well, I believe, Mr. Spivak, that both parties share equally in the responsibility of finding the answers. But the basic problem at the bargaining table with the Ford Motor Company currently is that the company is unwilling to discuss the economics of our negotiations based upon the economic facts. We have been saying from the very beginning of these negotiations that our workers are asking for equity. We want no more than that. We are determined to take no less. But the equity of a Ford worker should not be something arbitrary that we determine or something arbitrary that the company determines. That the workers' equity should be a reflection of the increase in productivity and the workers' share of that. And it seems to me that the only rational and responsible way to conduct collective bargaining within a free society is to base collective bargaining decisions on economic facts and not economic power.
Mr. Reuther, it's said that this strike is going to, which cost the workers $5 million a day, is it, in wages, is going to last at least 2 months. How long do you expect it to last?
Well, I'm not prepared to say it will last 2 months. We're going to do everything we can to encourage good faith, responsible, and meaningful collective bargaining, hopefully that we can resolve this at an earlier date. I'm not prepared to say it will last 2 months.
Well, now, do you think collective bargaining should be permitted to run its course, regardless of how long the strike lasts?
Well, I think that in a free society, both labor and management have got to recognize that while they each have their separate responsibilities, they do share a joint responsibility to the total community. And I believe that if both parties in this dispute will recognize that joint responsibility, then I believe that we can find the answers. We have done that in the past. We have had very little lost time in Fords. As a matter of fact, less than 0.2% over the last 20 years. So I believe that the parties involved can, by good faith collective bargaining, find the answers.
Why did you strike Ford rather than General Motors or Chrysler, Mr. Reuther?
Well, we made that decision for several reasons. We made the decision because the Ford workers had asked us for authorization. After all, this is not a strike that I called. The Ford workers overwhelmingly, by a secret democratic vote, ask that unless they get that measure of equity that they feel that the increase in productivity entitles them to, then they were prepared to strike to get their equity if the company would not give it to them. And I think that you've got to look at the facts that overwhelmingly the Ford workers voted by 97% in the Rouge plant, which is the largest Ford local. There are 34,000 workers there. 31,000 workers participated in the secret balloting, and they voted 98%. And so we didn't call this on top. This is a strike of Ford workers because they believe that they have problems that they need to find answers to. And whenever the Ford Motor Company will sit down and discuss the economics based upon the facts and will deal with some of the other human problems in terms of working conditions, etc., we will get a contract.
You have no contract any longer with General Motors or with Chrysler, is that true?
No, we are working without a contract. We asked both of those corporations to extend the contract so that we could minimize the current difficulty and ensure maximum stability in this industry, and both the General Motors Corporation and the Chrysler Corporation refused to extend the contracts, and so we are working without a contract.
Are we to understand from what you've said that the workers of General Motors and of Chrysler have not asked for a strike?
They did, but they asked for strike authorization under circumstances where they knew that we would only authorize a strike with one major company because we are trying to minimize the strike impact upon the general economy, and so we picked one corporation.
Thank you, Mr. Reuther. We'll continue the questions now with Mr. Jones.
Mr. Reuther, President Johnson has endorsed a railroad shopcraft settlement that would raise wage rates about 5.5% a year. I'm wondering how this would affect your negotiations in the auto industry.
Well, we've made it clear, Mr. Jones, from the very beginning that we believe that the equity of a Ford worker ought to be determined by the economics in the Ford Motor Company, by the increase in productivity in the Ford plants. And therefore, we are going to insist that the Ford equity flow from the increased productivity in Fords. And what happens in the railroad industry is really, I think, beside the point.
Does that mean, then, that you would be willing to settle for less than 5.5%?
We will settle for that figure that represents the equity of Ford workers. We don't want any more than our share. We will take no less. We have made it very clear that we do not want one red cent that will require a price increase. We are advocating that the industry cut the price because we believe that if you look at the facts, in the last 3 years, and we've had a three-year agreement with the Ford Motor Company, the Ford Motor Company made $7,000 profit per worker per year. And they could cut the price of a car $150, give our people an 80 cents an hour overall wage increase, and still make a profit larger than the average profits of manufacturing industries in general in America. And so we want our equity out of that increased productivity.
Now, you estimate Ford's productivity, I believe, at about 6%.
It's between 6 and 7%.
Then can you settle for less than that increase in productivity?
We will settle based upon the facts.
Does that mean you will not settle for less than the increase in productivity?
Well, I see no reason why Ford workers should be denied their measure of that increase in productivity. They only want their share of it. They don't want the consumer share. They don't want the stockholder share. And they don't want the share that rightfully ought to go to corporation executives. But why should workers and their families be shortchanged just because a powerful corporation is unwilling to discuss their equity based upon the economic facts?
American Motors Corporation has been having a more difficult time than some of the other companies in sales and earnings in recent years. I'm wondering if you'll insist that they sign a contract that's on the same pattern as the more profitable auto companies.
Well, if you will look at the history of the collective bargaining efforts with the automotive industry and the UAW, you will find that when the American Motor Car Company was in difficulty before, we made special concessions to them because we know that there are no economic Santa Clauses. You can't get something when there's nothing there to be had. And so we will deal with the economic facts in that situation. But I think we need to understand that if the workers in AMC took a substantial wage cut, that in itself will not solve the basic economic problem of American Motors. That flows out of the fact that no company can survive in this highly competitive industry with less than 5% of the total market. That's the basic problem.
Mr. Mollenhauer.
Mr. Ruther, some time ago, several years ago, you were talking in terms of some kind of an international minimum wage. Was that serious discussion? Have you been doing anything about that since, from the standpoint of protection of the automobile workers?
Now, what we were talking about, Mr. Mollenhauer, was that we felt that the free world had to achieve higher and higher levels of economic integration. We do not believe the free world can meet the challenges of the 20th century if we divide the free world into little airtight economic national compartments. So we need maximum integration. And we said, therefore, the free world labor movement would have to deal with trying to establish some basic minimums so that one nation did not exploit another nation because it had low wages.
Well, in the steel industry more recently, both the steel unions as well as the steel companies, there's been concern over American products pricing themselves out of the market and the need for some kind of protection. Now, you're basically against protection.
That's right. Our union believes in free trade, and we have never asked for tariffs to keep out the importation of foreign-made cars.
Well, do you see any problem in the automobile industry over a period of time of pricing yourself, American labor, pricing itself out of the competitive field internationally?
No, because, you see, so long as we base our wage increases and our improvement in fringe benefits upon increased productivity, that does not increase the cost per unit. As a matter of fact, if you take the movement of wages in the American economy and the movement of wages in the European economy, you will find that American wages put American products in a more favorable competitive position today than they did 10 years ago.
Well, Mr. Ruther, with regard to the minimum wage, The other countries around the world do not have minimum wages. Do you consider this to represent any kind of a problem with regard to the United States generally competing with the rest of the world?
Well, the free world labor movement is working to try to get workers in other countries
Well, even Sweden, they don't have one, which is one of the most progressive in this respect that there is.
Well, their wage structure grew up on a different historical background than ours. You needn't have a national minimum wage in each country to meet this problem. It can be met many ways. What we're trying to say is that if we're going to achieve a higher degree of economic integration between the industrialized nations and the free world, then their competition should not be based upon the exploitation of labor. It ought to be based upon sound and constructive economic forces.
It is rather widespreadly felt that neither in your negotiations with Ford, you never got down to substantive bargaining. And there's one allegation that you never spelled out in any sort of detail what you wanted.
Well, I've seen that sort of story in the press, Mr. Kaplow, but the simple facts are that we made it very clear from the beginning of these negotiations precisely what our priorities were. We talked about a substantial wage increase for all of our members. We talked about improved pensions. One of the basic problems we've got now is that we can't protect the widows the way they ought to be protected.
Well, did you ever get into really where you're hammering back and forth?
They know precisely what our priorities are. They have been spelled out simply and clearly, and they understand. The problem, I believe, Mr. Kaplow, is that the industry got together and made a decision. And that decision, I think, now has created a box in which the Ford Motor Company is the prisoner. And until they free themselves from the box which I think General Motors essentially has built around them, then they won't be able to get down to good faith, meaningful bargaining. We are prepared. I said to the company on Friday, we will move here if you will move. Are you prepared to make a discussion? They said, no, we are not prepared to change anything.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Ruther, Ford said that last year's dollar sales rose 6% from 1965, but that the company's profits dropped 12%. Now, since you're talking about really a share of the profits, if the Ford loses money, would you take a cut in wages? Would you have your workers in Ford take a cut in wages?
Well, Mr. Spivak, the workers that I have the privilege and responsibility representing in Ford, they understand you can't get something out of nothing. In 1945, and I have copies of those letters here that we told the Ford Motor Company about, in 1945, the Ford Motor Company wrote our union and said that productivity had not gone up, our profit position was not favorable, and we want now to bargain within the framework of that unfavorable productivity profitability picture. And we did. Now in 1967, when their profits are high, and the Ford Motor Company made in the last 5 years roughly 22% return on its investment after taxes, when their profits are high and their productivity is up, they say, oh, no, we don't want to talk about that. This is why they didn't accept our arbitration proposal. We said, here is a good faith arbitration proposal. Let's submit this to a court of impartial judgment and let them make a decision based upon the facts. They said no to that because the facts support our demand and does not support the company's current position.
Well, I don't quite get your answer. If the Ford Motor Company should lose money in the future, would your workers take a cut in wages?
When we deal, first of all, the Ford Motor Company is not about to get into that position, but if then we would be obligated to negotiate within the framework of those economic facts. The answer is yes.
Mr. Jones.
Mr. Ruther, you mentioned the arbitration proposal that you had made to Ford, and yet the arbitration offer was included certain criteria which Ford felt that they would have to make a concession in granting the arbitration. And I'm wondering, if you really wanted arbitration, why didn't you simply request arbitration without imposing any criteria?
Well, Mr. Jones, we submitted a good faith, clean-cut arbitration proposal, and we suggested that the criteria ought to be the increase in productivity. Because an arbitrator shouldn't use a Ouija board. He ought to base his decisions and his recommendations based upon facts. The facts in this situation is the question of increase in productivity. But if the Ford Motor Company, it took them 8 hours to reject our offer, if they were prepared to arbitrate on another basis, then they should have submitted a counter-arbitration proposal, and we would have given that consideration. But they made it clear that no matter what the framework of the arbitration, they would not agree to arbitrate under any circumstances. I think they made a serious mistake, because this strike could have been avoided had they accepted arbitration.
Turning to another subject, Mr. Reuther, you have denounced the AFL-CIO as being the complacent custodian of the status quo, and the auto workers have hinted that they'll pull out of the Federation if the Federation does not go along with a broad program that you've set forth. I was wondering if you could tell me specifically what is the auto workers' price for remaining in the AFL-CIO?
Well, we don't want to divide the American labor movement. We want to revitalize it and modernize it and make it equal to the challenges and the opportunities in the 20th century. We want to make the labor movement into a vital instrument for constructive and creative social change that relate to the problems not only of wage earners, but the total community. Now, when we had our special collective bargaining convention some months back, that convention made a decision that we would not pursue this difference with the AFL-CIO until after our bargaining is settled. And therefore, I'm not free to discuss it in detail, but if Mr. Spivak will invite me back after our bargaining is settled, I should be most happy to talk about this with you.
A little less than 3 minutes, Mr. Mollenhoff.
Mr. Reuther, you spoke about increases in pay for all of your members, and you do have some little problem there that you have the auto workers as such and then the skilled group. As I understand it, the skilled groups can drag this strike out even after your automobile workers generally have agreed to it. Now, do you see any conflict of interest in you representing both groups under these circumstances? And is there any reason why you shouldn't give these skilled workers the kind of a craft severance that they've mentioned from time to time?
Well, they made that decision when they joined our union originally, and the Labor Board has held that the appropriate collective bargaining unit in the automotive industry is an industrial unit. I think you would have total chaos if you fragmented the bargaining unit in the automobile industry. Now, I think this whole problem of the skilled trades workers versus the production workers has been blown way up out of proportion. We have done for many years what we are going to do this year about the right of skilled workers to vote separately. And we will manage this. We have never had a major contract rejected by our membership, and they have to vote to ratify it by secret democratic ballot. So this is a manageable problem that we will work out.
Mr. Kaplow.
Mr. Reuther, the Minneapolis Tribune published the results of a poll this morning. One of the points made was people of Minnesota seem to think more highly of General Motors than they do of the United Automobile Workers. 57% expressed approval of General Motors, 35% approved the UAW. Why do you think that's so, if it's so?
Well, I'd like to know how the questions were put.
All it says here is expressed approval of.
Well, I don't know whether General Motors sponsored that poll or not. The fact is that what we are doing, we believe, relates to the basic needs of men and women and their right to share in the greater productivity that their labor makes possible. And we're going to fight that good fight because that's how we make progress in this free country of ours. And we're not going to be influenced by any polls of that kind. Our problems will be settled at the bargaining table, we hope, based upon facts and not based upon power.
Briefly, Mr. Spivak.
You've been critical of monopoly power in industry. How do you justify your own monopoly power to shut down an entire industry, Mr. Reuther?
We don't exercise monopoly power. We represent the workers who work in this industry. And when those workers are denied their measure of justice, as members of a free society, they have a right to withhold their labor power. It's not a monopoly. We're willing to extend the contracts with two of the big three, and they refuse. They are acting as though they were organizing a monopoly, not the UAW.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but our time is up. Thank you, Mr. Reuther, for being with us today on Meet the Press.